Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tia and I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on abluechipspeaker.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, our speaker is Rick, and let's welcome him.
Hey, how y'all doing tonight? My name's Rick, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm up here, I guess, to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that some of you might get something from my message. If not, you can go to sleep. That's okay. I won't mind. I'll try to entertain you as best I can. I don't know. I'm not much of an entertainer. But to start off, the first time I drank, I was 12 years old. And I got drunk as a skunk with my friends. I had a few beers, and then I started mixing martinis in my mouth out of my parents' liquor cabinet there. And that's the way I would drink pretty much for the rest of my life. You know, when I drank to get drunk. I never had just a few drinks. Never tried to manage it in any way whatsoever. I was just a hardcore alcoholic right from the very beginning. I don't know if I had the genes or whatever. Don't really matter. All I know is I have this thing, and it's got me, and it tore me apart for years and years and years. By the time I was 14, I was, you know, hanging out with the lower crowd. I, as a kid, I did really good in school, and I was in sports, and I grew up in a pretty good family, upper middle class. It was a little crazy, dysfunctional, just like everybody's family, but more or less normal until I came around and started using. Alcohol was my love, was my DOC, but I dipped and dabbed in other things as well as a kid, and I quickly got really into just being a bad kid, you know, not the good kid that I had been when I was growing up. It wasn't unusual for me to tip my dad's scotch bottle in the morning when I was in the eighth grade and go to school drunk like that, and then meet my friends and smoke some weed, and you know, that was school for me. Quickly went downhill. When I was 16, my parents moved from Pennsylvania to Conyers, Georgia. That was quite the culture shock for me. Being a Yankee and then living out there in cow country, this was pretty crazy. And I right off started hanging around with the lowest of the lowest crowd and partying and drinking. And I was the worst of the worst of the worst, unfortunately. And these kids like got sick and tired of me taking me out on weekends, and I'd get so drunk that I wouldn't know my own name or where I was going. And that was pretty much the way it went for me through the rest of high school. I did manage to get into college. I went to the University of Georgia. After my third quarter, I had a 0.03 average. They summarily discharged me and told me that I needed to probably go to another school, get my grades up a little bit, see if I could come back. I had a relationship while I was in college there, and that culminated into pregnancy. And my girlfriend disappeared on me when she got pregnant. And I'll get back into that story a little bit more, but I was never able to see my son grow up. But today I have a relationship with him. I met him. I didn't meet him until he was 30 years old. That was really, really hard. I did a lot of drinking over that one. But he's a good kid now. He went to the university, or he went to Georgia Tech, got a double E degree in engineering, and did real well, and then decided that he wanted to get out of engineering and now lives up in Blairsville, up in the hinterlands of Georgia. As far as I know right now, what he's doing is door dashing for a living. So. But he's happy. He wasn't happy as an engineer. Kind of has something to do with my career, too. I went into my first rehab was Peachford back in 1983. I was 20 years old. Peachford was a real nice place back then. I don't know if any of you have been in there since. It's a dump now. It was like Club Med. We had swimming pools and tennis courts and baseball field, pool table, and nice big old color TV. Is it still like that? It got better because I was there.
It's rotting,
man. Yeah, I hadn't been there since, and it wasn't quite so nice. But I got a good education, you know. I got that education about alcoholism and, you know, what it is, and the disease of alcoholism, the obsessive thinking, and the compulsive drinking. And, but I wasn't ready, and I stayed sober for about 9 months, and then started drinking again. And I remember after that 9 months of first time being sober, drinking that first beer was like the most wonderful feeling that I think I ever had in my life. And I was like right back to it. And within 3 days, I was drinking Bacardi 151 up in a hotel somewhere. Just guzzling it down. And got real, real sick. Real sick. And snapped. My brain kind of snapped on that relapse. And I went into Peachford again, into their detox. They had a locked ward back then. And I was in that detox for 10 days. And I had only drank for about 6 days. They didn't know what was wrong with me. And, for the next year, I was in and out of treatment facilities, relapsing, and then ultimately into my first mental hospital. They had diagnosed me with severe depression and anxiety disorder. I've been diagnosed with just about everything since then. I did come back from that. When I was 24 years old, I finally put the plug in the jug, and I would ultimately stay sober for 22 years. During that time, I was sober in AA. Had a sponsor, worked the steps, I sponsored people. I did a lot of service work, was a GSR, DCM, chaired committees at the district level, at the area level. Very involved. I've met my wife. We ultimately bought a farm. We owned a 16-acre farm up in northeastern Connecticut. Raised pigs and chickens. I was a beekeeper. Did all kinds of cool stuff. Went to school. I went to graduate school up there in Connecticut. I got a PhD in cell and molecular biology in 1998. And I started off on a career in that area. Did a couple of postdocs, and then worked as a professor at the University of Connecticut, and then up at Northeastern University. I was a professor up there, had students, had a lab, did the whole nine yards, and I had too much going on, folks. You know, I had the farm. I was commuting from Connecticut to Boston, which is a terrible commute. And I was trying to run a program, and I burned out. And started to have that anxiety again that I had experienced when I was younger. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor gave me some pill for the anxiety. And the pill was Klonopin. Klonopin worked really well for the anxiety. I took the first one compliantly. Everyone after that, no. took it as I felt I needed it. And that was more than I should have been taking. Quickly got addicted to that drug. And well, about that time, I used to ride back and forth when I was working at the University of Connecticut. I had a 7-mile commute. This was before I was working at Northeastern. And I had a moped. I had a little moped, zing, 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 you know. That would do me my 7 miles on a couple of sips of gasoline. And I'm cruising home one day and come up a hill and then down around a corner, and I get that sucker doing about 30, which is its maximum speed. And there's a deer coming the other way doing about 30 also, which is about its maximum speed. And you know, physics and all kind of resulted in us being in the same place at the same time. And that meant the moped stopped and I went. And I went over and landed on my head. Fortunately, my wife, a couple of weeks before, had demanded that I wear a helmet on this moped, so I didn't crack my skull, but I did crack my back. I have 15 rib fractures. A nicked aorta, and I was a mess. And they said, you need to take Percocet for this. And I said, yeah, I need to take Percocet for this. So they gave me about 90 Percocet, and I started taking Percocet with Klonopin, which you're not supposed to do, opiates and benzos. And that set me off on a real great tangent there. After the Percocet, then it was the Oxycontin, and the Oxycontin got up to about 80 milligrams a day. And then they started titrating me off. They said, you can't be taking so much Oxycontin anymore, especially with these Klonopins, so we're going to have to titrate you down. And they titrated me down until it got down to about, I don't know, 10 milligrams, and I started to feel really, really bad. Now, I worked for a drug development lab. That was my job in Northeastern at that time. We worked on cannabinoid receptors, you know, those guys are those things that THC reacts to, CBD and all that happy marijuana stuff. But I knew about drugs, and this was early Suboxone. And I figured I needed to get on the Suboxone plan to get off these oxycodones. And so I went to a Suboxone doctor, and that was back when they gave you the little tabs that you could snort if you wanted to. Can't chew them because they have enough trexone in them, but you snort them pretty good. So I started snorting the Suboxone. I don't know how much Suboxone I was taking. I was taking more than I should. I didn't get things off the street or off the internet. I could have. I tried. I thought about it. But pretty much everything I got by script. But I had doctors, you know. We had different doctors get us different things, different amounts, different times. We figure these things out. And sometimes you got to go to the emergency room, right? You know? My pills got stolen from my car, man. What am I going to do? And they would go, well, Yeah, you seem. I'm a doctor too, man. See, I gotta teach. I'm not a drug addict. And they would give me what I wanted. So that was pretty much my relapse. And I hadn't drank yet. And I was actually still going, hey, hey, man. I was still sponsoring people. I was still doing service work. And all these drugs, you know, were just because I needed them. Because I had a broken back and I had a broken head. And I knew I was lying to myself. And, you know, I had people in AA who knew I was lying to myself. And they tried to straighten me out, and I got rid of all my sponsees, and I tried to stop, and I went into programs, I went into a place, I was up in Connecticut at this time. I lived up in Connecticut for 30 years, I'm really a Connecticut boy, I'm not a Georgia boy, but I've been here for 5 years now, so I'm getting used to it, I'm getting used to the traffic. Boy, I hate the traffic is horrible. Driving around here is like, I just close my eyes. I start driving myself. Yeah, just get in the river there. I'm just waiting for those drive your own or drive themselves cars, so I don't have to drive this crazy crap. But anyway, where were we? Okay, so. You know, I finally get honest with myself and I say, you know, I need to do something about this drug problem. And I come down from Connecticut, I come down back to Peachford again, because I knew Peachford from like 30 years before. Thought it was a good place, you know, it was like Charter Peachford or something at that point. And I came in and I loaded myself up with all the Suboxone and all the Klonopin that I had, and I was just really wasted when I was in there the first couple of days. And I thought, well, I've been off these drugs for 2 days now. I must be doing pretty good. I guess I'm not going to have problems with withdrawals. You know, I told my psychiatrist that, and he said, yeah, maybe you're going to be okay. But I didn't take anything while I was in the hospital, but I had so much in me. And then it finally, after the third day, it came out. And something about Klonopin withdrawals or benzo withdrawals, if anybody had them without any, you know, titration, they're pretty freaky, man. I started going off in a realm that I didn't think was even possible. I was floating up in the top of my room there, man. It's just like writing letters to my ex-wife at that time, trying to figure things out, and just, you know, trying to solve the problems of the world, and just going completely crazy. And then the anxiety hit me, and I just like ramped out, and I went down to the nurse's station, just begged for something. Fortunately, my psychiatrist was still on call, and he came by, and he gave me a Valium, I think, and I chilled out, at least for that night. But then I went into, after Peachford, I went into Talbot. Anybody familiar with Talbot down there? Down there in the College Park area back then. They're still around other places now. For, it was for professionals, like, you know, doctors and nurses and airplane pilots. The airplane pilots always got off in like 6 weeks. I don't know why that is. Because they kept us for 3 months, but the airplane pilots. You wonder about that. You think the airplane pilots just stay a little longer than them. Up there flying planes. They get a little more severe treatment. But nope, they let them out in 6 weeks. I didn't do well at Talbot. I had sunk back into that. Mainly I was just coming off the drugs, you know. They titrated me off the Suboxone pretty fast. They titrated me off the Klonopin pretty fast. And I just went sideways, and I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't function. I was a complete, utter mess. And ultimately, they boosted me out, and then I went back up to Connecticut. And I spent about 3 years, folks, let me tell you, just about 3 years just lying in bed. not functioning, not working, not doing anything. A complete mess. And that was when my wife had divorced me, but she didn't kick me out of the house. We still had this big farm. She was taking care of the farm, and I was just taking care of the bed. And I was not really helping her at all. And, I went that way for... Oh, boy, this is when I started going into mental hospitals. And ECTs, folks. I've had over 30 ECTs in my life. Electroconvulsive therapy, where they shock your brain with 30 joules of electricity and go into convulsion. And they say, you're good. You're cured. And I don't know if it helped me much, but I sure did like getting put to sleep. That was nice. Ketamine and propofol or whatever else they throw in you. Put you right to sleep. That was nice. No, I don't think the ECTs help me very much. I don't know if they help anybody. They do ECTs at Peachford now on anybody. As much as they can, they run you through like a... I'm not going to get into that. That's their opinion. That's what they think helps. And so that's what they do. So I went that route, and I was in psychiatric facilities. And most of the time when I was in a psychiatric facility... How you doing, Frank?
How you doing?
Good to see you. Glad you came. Late, but good. Frank heard my story a couple of weeks ago. I'm moving along really fast, too, so we're going to get out of here early. So don't worry about that. But I do want to talk a little about recovery. So somewhere along the line, recovery did come. I don't know, is this like my third or fourth time in Peachford? I was 10-13. I came down to Georgia again. I was in a treatment of residential facility called Discovery House out there in, where is that? Gwinnett. I used to do easy 1-2-3 meetings a lot when I was up there. Good little group up there. Clarkston's the best, though. Clarkston's the best. I'm a member of Clarkston. I would carp out. I'd go nuts when I was up in this place and tell them I was going to kill myself, and they'd take me to the hospital, and then they'd 10-13 me. I was in Ridgeview, Lakeview twice, Peachford. Last time I was in Peachford, I had this sister who was a blessing. My sister has saved my ass more than once. She's pulled me out of hotel rooms, brought me to detoxes. She's put me up. I had 3 heart attacks back in 2017, October and November. Coronary blockages that put stents in me. And then I OD'd and I blew the stents, and I had 2 more heart attacks. They had to paddle me awake. And I was intubated for 10 days. And really, really, really sick. They were getting ready to give me last rites. So I was close to dead. And jails, institutions, and death, you know. So I've been to the death, and I've been to the institutions, and guess what? I went to jail too. That's another story. I'll tell that real quick. I was in jail for 5 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. As a result of, I got 2 DUIs in 1 week, and they were both collisions. I hurt people, and I hurt myself. Got scars to prove it. And got sued $200,000, so one of them got from me. And I was down here in Georgia, and the DUIs were up in Connecticut, and I was down here in Georgia for 5 years before they caught up with me. My sister kept in touch with the police officers and told me, he's down here, he's in treatment facilities, he's getting help. And they said, okay, just call us again in 6 months. So she kept calling in 6 months. And then when I finally got out of my last, I was in Breakthrough, the last place that I was in. Anyway, when I finally got out of there, someone called up somebody and said, yeah, he's out. So they got in touch with me and they finally arrested me. I hadn't got arrested for the DUI, so I got a lawyer, and she was trying to push to get it dumped because it had been so many years, and it was all kind of messed up, the paperwork and everything. But prosecutors wanted me to do at least 5 days. So I got to do 5 days in a hard jail, in a nasty, disgusting, horrible jail where we were locked down the whole time. I couldn't take a shower. They stuffed the food underneath the door. They would not unlock that door. And we were in quarantine. I couldn't make a phone call. I didn't know if they were ever going to let me out. I was freaking out. I was really like, I can't imagine anybody who's done hard time for a long time, because I would have gone crazy. Fortunately, after 5 days, they let me out, and I was very, very grateful, very grateful. So jails, institutions, and death, I've come close to death, and I've pretty much done everything else. So anyway, back the story up a little bit. So I was in Peachford, and my sister, you know, she was trying to talk to me. I said to her, I said, you know, what makes you want to, why do you want to live? You know, I couldn't understand it. It was just, life was just so horrible. It was so painful. So much anxiety, so much depression, so much misery. And she said, I just want you to, you know, you're my last relative. You know, and I want you to do okay. I want you to get better. You know, I want to grow old with you, you know. And something about what she said and the way she said it made me have an inkling, just an inkling of like, you know, maybe there's purpose here. Maybe I got something more to do in this life. You know, maybe this isn't the end. And you know, the drugs had started to get out of my system. And that was when I went into Breakthrough, and I started to feel a little bit better. Still struggling, waking up in the morning with a lot of anxiety, but you know, they gave me structure, you know, which was something that I hadn't had. They got me up, they got me to yoga. I did yoga in the morning, it was 3 days a week. And they got me to groups, and the groups were okay, you know. I mean, I was talking to people, I was getting to know people again. You know, I was opening up, talking about my feelings, you know, stuff, what's going on in my head, you know, because I was so alone in that mental craziness, loneliness. Loneliness, I think, is something that is one of the most painful things of addiction, that loneliness. It's a disease of loneliness. And, you know, during this time of me being in and out of places, I would relapse. You know, I would relapse because I just couldn't stand the way I felt anymore. And it wasn't like, oh, I forgot what drinking would do to me. You know, I knew it was going to happen. I knew I was going to end up in a detox somewhere. And I went on this one drunk. It was pretty much like the last bad drunk I went on. I'm not sure what happened, but I ended up in a hotel, and the last thing I remember drinking was like a six-pack of 16-ounce Budweiser. And I don't remember drinking anything after that, but apparently I did drink a lot, because at one point I was running around naked in the continental breakfast area. I remember that. And they brought me back to my room. They didn't call the police. I was a fixture there, I guess, for a week. I must have been drinking like a lot of Rot Gut vodka, because they found the bottles there. And ultimately, my sister found me, like she usually does. And they came in the EMTs and brought me to the hospital. And I had 0.4 alcohol content, so I was dead, supposedly. I was in alcohol coma for 3 days. They couldn't bring me to in this local hospital, so they sent me to Hartford, the big hospital there, and I only remember a little bit of that. I was at one point they had me in a bed with a cage over it, so I guess I kept trying to escape or something like that, and they had me strapped down. Boy, I've been strapped down a lot too. Anybody been strapped down before? Yeah, that's a blast. Ridgeview used to do you in a rubber room with your ankles and your wrists strapped behind your back, and they'd leave you on your stomach. And then they'd come in, they'd peek in there, and they'd see if you were doing all right. They'd give you a shoot of booty juice and put you out, and then you'd wake up and you'd be going crazy. Strapped down a lot. I go crazy when I drink. I'm really a pretty mellow dude. But when I drink, I just go off into some other kind of realm. I'm another person. I'm a beast. And I'm just a little dude, and I'll go trying to beat guys up twice my size, and I get the shit kicked out of me. Bad. Anyway, I digress. I started to get my act together when I was up at Breakthrough, and slowly but surely the days got better, and I got better. And we did our thing there. We did our Fun Fridays. Anybody go to Breakthrough? Fun Fridays? Nobody knows about Fun Fridays. They're not fun. You sit in a parking lot and it's hotter than hell. And you're moving like backwards a little bit farther to the end of the parking lot so you can stay in the shade as the day gets longer and longer. And the guy, Chris J., he's the guy that runs the place. He's a character. Yeah. But anyway, it was a good place for me. It saved my ass. It truly saved my ass, and it was where I needed to be at the time. And that was where my sobriety started. And I got a good sponsor. And I had gone through the steps many times before, but this guy took me through them again, and I started over. I started from the beginning. I started on step one, I was powerless over alcohol. I was powerless over drugs. See, I didn't think I was powerless over drugs. And that's why I went back to them. The drugs took me down just as hard as any alcohol would. And the alcohol was always going to come after the drugs. And my life was entirely unmanageable. I had a really hard time with the obsession. Anybody have that problem? No. I want to drink. I don't want to drink. I want to drink. I don't want to drink. I'm going to drink. I'm not going to drink. That drove me crazy. And I was with a friend. We were out in her back stoop, and I said, Ruth, this obsession is driving me crazy. If it doesn't go away, I will never be able to stop drinking. I will always pick up drinking. She said, why don't you ask God to remove the obsession? And I said, I've done that. I've done that 1,000 times, and he just won't do it. I don't know why. I don't understand. She said, ask him. Ask him. And I asked God to remove the obsession. And nothing happened. And then a few days later, I wasn't thinking about drinking. You know? And that was a miracle for me. That was an absolute miracle for me. And I hit the ground running after that. You know? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had witnessed that sanity, that release of the obsession to drink. And I made a decision at that point to turn my will and my life over to a higher power, something greater than me. See, I thought I had all the answers. You know, I had all the information. I had all the knowledge. I knew everything there was to know about drugs. I had a PhD, man. Come on, you know, God doesn't have a PhD. I had a PhD. And it turned out that I didn't have the answers at all. I was a fool. I was a fool living a fool's life. And today, you know, I wake up in the morning and I tell God, I said, God, I want to live. When I wake up in the morning, that's the first thing I say. Today I want to live. And then I start to say my prayers. You know, help me to work your will in my life. Help me to work your will in my life. Because that's what I need to do in order to maintain, in order to make it through the day, in order to be functional, in order to be someone who's useful and valuable. So I did my Searching and Fearless Moral Inventory with my sponsor, and I did my fifth step with my sponsor, and I learned a lot about myself. And the one thing I learned was I had this terrible, terrible low self-esteem, man. You know, I basically hated myself. I hated what I'd done to the people in my life. I hated the way I'd lived my life for all those years, and I needed to forgive myself. You know, I needed to let go of some of that self-loathing, and mostly all that was just self-absorption, you know, selfishness. So this is a disease of selfishness, and I was self-centered to the extreme. And it wasn't until I started to think about someone else, other people like my son and my sister who cared for me so much, and my mother who recently passed away, you know, that I started to feel better about myself. And to care about you guys. You know, you guys are here listening to me blab, and I'm talking and talking, and I'm going to shut up pretty soon so that y'all can go home. But I cherish that. This is an honor for me to be able to do this, and for you guys to maybe gain something from what I have to say. Today, you know, I try to work on my defects of character, and you know, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. I know that's not something that's going to happen like that. For me, it's something that takes work. Faith without works is dead. I was having trouble with patience there a while back. And I said, God, man, I need help with this patience thing. And he helped me all right. And I was challenged with patience everywhere I turned, especially on the road out there. Yeah. And that's how it works for me, you know. That's how he'll give me that. He'll give me that. He'll relieve me of that defect of character, but I need to work for it. I need to do what I need to do, what I need to do in order to be a better person and to grow and to be somebody who's a constructive citizen, not a destructive citizen. So, I don't know. The program has been many things to me over the years. It's It's definitely saved my ass. I can't imagine. They say there are other methods to recovery, and you know, one thing that I'm doing now is I just got certified for CARES, Certified Addiction Recovery Empowerment Specialist for CPS addiction. So, and I passed the test, and I did all the things that you have to do for that. And I want to make that my goal for the rest of my life, to work with alcoholics, to work with people in addiction. CARES has an interesting philosophy. It's not entirely cohesive with AA, but it doesn't affect my embodiment of this program. I understand that there's other methods out there. If people do get sober, I don't know how, but they do, and I have to respect that. That's the reality. But for me, AA is the solution. The steps of AA are the solution. These meetings, you people, are the solution. I do sponsor people today, you know. I've had that spiritual awakening sufficient to recover from this disease. And I'm much better than I was. After 22 years, I'm better than I was now after 3 years and 3 months. There's something about a relapse that you don't need to do, and you don't need to go through what I went through. But I'm grateful that I went through everything that I went through to bring me where I am today. Because I have something to offer people who go through these kind of things. And they have something to offer me, you know, every day. Every day, you know, I get up and I do this thing. You know, I hit a meeting. I meet people. I talk to people. I let go of my shit. I try to be a functional and effective person. And with that, I'm grateful. And I'm grateful for y'all listening to me tonight. I hope I said something worth listening to. Not, that's cool too. Y'all take care.
Thank you, Rick. That was great.
Keep it simple. go. Simple for me.